morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 14, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya's president meets President Joe Biden today, Thursday, at the White House.
I think our position, which is the position of the African Union, is that we will continue to seek dialogue on all sides. We will continue calling for an immediate cessation of hostilities by both sides.
Sudan's security agency denies imposing a travel ban on some civilian members of the power-sharing government. Human Rights Watch demands meaningful justice in Central African Republic. Malawi government attempts to justify fuel price increase. A Botswana court reserves judgment after state appeals gay sex ruling. And rumors of racialistic killings instill fears in Liberians.
Racialistic killing in Liberia is really serious in a few days. And it's going to increase because the police aren't talking anything about it. I'm investigating it. Rather, they are telling us that there is nothing happening.
And Senegal and fossil fuel investments. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Joe Biden will today, Thursday, host Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta at the White House. This will be President Biden's first ever meeting with an African leader as president. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, the two leaders are expected to discuss democracy, human rights, economic growth, and peace and security in Ethiopia.
In a statement, White House spokesperson Jen Psaki said that President Uhuru Kenyatta and President Joe Biden are today meeting to discuss peace and security, economic growth, and tackle climate change. Kenya, which is holding the rotational presidency of the United Nations Security Council for this month, has promised the UN member states of diversity, state building, and search for peace in a meeting chaired in New York by Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta. The Biden administration is considering disciplinary action regarding the worsening crisis in neighboring Ethiopia, where thousands have been killed. And when President Uhuru Kenyatta was asked on how Africa plans to deal with the situation in Ethiopia, he said that the African Union will call for a national dialogue for all parties involved in conflict.
I think our position, which is the position of the African Union, is that we will continue to seek dialogue on all sides. We will continue calling for an immediate cessation of hostilities by both sides. We will continue to urge for the need to have a political resolution because we do not believe that there is any military solution, and we need to urgently have all parties coming across a table. And we will continue to push, not just as Kenya, as a neighbor and a member of the Security Council, but also through the African Union and through our regional body, which is IGAD.
The Ethiopian government has rejected international interference in its affairs. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on the troubled countries to embrace peace.
My thanks to the government of Kenya for convening today's debate on the important issue of diversity, state building, and peace. Your team captures a crucial but often overlooked idea that peace is not found in a piece of paper. It is found in people. Parties to conflict can agree to end hostilities. They can agree to begin the long process of rebuilding a country, and they can even join forces to reconstitute a government.
Presidents Biden and Kenyatta will also discuss trade, the need to bring transparency and accountability to domestic and international financial systems. This comes at a time when the Kenya Private Sector Alliance, KEPSA, and the Corporate Council on Africa on Monday signed a US-Kenya trade initiative that aims at upscaling small and medium-sized enterprises. Flori Liza is the Chief Executive Officer, Corporate Council on Africa.
The US-Kenya SME trade initiative is a vision of CCA and KEPSA. And the concept for this initiative came from a desire that Carol and I both have to take concrete steps to scale up U.S.-Kenya trade, recognizing that SMEs are a driving force.
The United States and Kenya have long cooperated on economic and security initiatives, including counterterrorism. Today's White House meeting marks President Biden's first ever one-on-one as a president with an African leader. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
The General Intelligence Service of Sudan says it did not impose a travel ban on some government officials. There were reports earlier this week that security officials prevented a prominent member of the Empowerment Removal Committee from leaving the country to Egypt because his name was on the exit control list. Reuters Wednesday quoted the GIS as saying that it is carrying out its duties as stipulated in the constitutional document. Suleiman Baldo is the senior advisor on Sudan and the Horn of Africa at the Century, an investigative and policy group. He said these are times of high tension in Sudan between the civilian component of the power-sharing transitional government and the military.
As you know, the transition in the country is a power-sharing arrangement between the military component and a civilian-led executive council of ministers. They're supposed to steer the country to elections in 2 more years now. However, over the last few weeks, the civilian component has been under a lot of pressure from the head of the army and splinter groups from some political parties to diminish the executive authorities of the cabinet and force it into resignation. And I believe the decision to ban some of the officials, several of the ministers in the cabinet and some are members of the Sovereign Council, is part of this push by the military to occupy more space in the power-sharing arrangement than the symbolic protocol and symbolic powers that it has at the moment.
We understand one of those people allegedly banned from traveling is the individual who said that or accused the military of trying to use the attempted coup to seize power. Is this kind of coincidental?
Nothing is coincidental. All the officials who are all civilians supposedly banned from travel are ones who stood up for the claims by the military to claim more power than what is authorized under the constitutional arrangement governing the transitional period. And therefore, the military wants to see them purged from the government and to try and appoint in the public opinion people who are hardliners and so on. The only mistake being to stand up for the military in their attempt to encroach on powers that the constitutional document didn't award them.
The businessman that you said traveled to Egypt, who is also on the list, is he coming back to Sudan?
This is a political fight between two components in the transition, and the civilians are not going to stand down. In particular, the cabinet is supported by a large segment of the population. People want democracy. People want to have the country run by civilians and to have civilians oversee the military and their economic establishments. And this is the real source of the tension.
Suleiman Baldo is the senior advisor on Sudan and the Horn of Africa at the Century, an investigative and policy group. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Consumer rights groups in Malawi are calling on the government to roll back or reduce a recent increase in the price of fuel that they say the average Malawian cannot afford. President Lazarus Chakwera said this week he was concerned with the 22% increase, but stressed that it was the result of rising petroleum prices globally. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Sylvester Nami was the executive director for the Center for Democracy and Economic Development Initiatives, one of the groups demanding the government to do something to caution Malawians against the effects of the fuel price increase. He said the higher price has come at the wrong time.
Fuel price hike is coming at a time when Malawians are already struggling to make ends meet due to punitive taxes, levies, and high interest rates. As a result, this has pushed up the price for basic services and amenities, for example, cooking oil, water, transport, even airtime for mobile phones.
Namiwa said the government should have done more than simply justify the fuel price increase. He also says officials could scrap levies attached to fuel, which he says drive prices even higher.
I'm saying every liter of fuel in Malawi has 8 levies in total on top of the tax. Now, it is high time that we should take away some of these levies that are justifiable. Out of the 8 levies, we have got a road levy. But if you check around Malawi, there is nowhere where there is a construction of the road that is funded through this levy.
The Malawi Energy Regulatory Authority said in a statement this week that the price changes was in response to a global rise in fuel costs, an explanation echoed by President Lazarus Chakwera. The regulatory body also cited a recent depreciation of Malawi's currency, the kwacha, against international currencies like the US dollar and the British pound. Gospel Kasako is Malawi's government spokesperson. He told reporters at a press conference Tuesday that the government is taking measures that will strengthen the value of Malawi's currency. He says as of now, we are increasing exports that would help beef up our foreign reserves as well as preventing our local currency from depreciating. So far, there have been no public protests against the price increase. Rights campaigner Namiwa said his organization will take action should the government fail to ease the impact of the increase on the average Malawian. He did not elaborate. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 14. In Liberia, mysterious deaths are said to be on the increase in the capital and other parts of the country. As Rita Jilabwe reports from Monrovia, Liberians are calling on their government to investigate frequent cases of unexplained dead bodies with missing parts.
Residents of Liberia's capital, Monrovia, are living in fear about the rising number of unexplained deaths in Montserrat County, seat of the nation's capital, and other parts of the country. Video footage of dead bodies with parts missing have been flooding the social media. In September, an audio recording of a woman narrating how she escaped death surfaced on social media. A week later, a man in his 40s with bruises on his face was seen in a video recording explaining how he escaped his kidnappers. Recently, a 13-year-old girl said she was kidnapped in Bomi, one of Liberia's 15 counties. The girl told police that she was kidnapped by two unidentified men who tied her hands and legs and put a cloth in her mouth. She says the men escaped when they heard some community residents approaching. Some Liberians believe ritualistic killers are responsible for these actions.
How can you kill somebody and extract their parts? And what is the purpose then? If you are extracting private parts and sensitive parts of a person, how do you describe such killing? It can definitely be labeled as ritualistic killing.
Ritualistic killing in Liberia is really serious if you this. And it's going to increase because the police aren't talking anything about it or aren't investigating it. Rather, they are telling us that there is nothing happening.
However, Police Inspector General Patrick Sudu, addressing the matter recently on the Liberia Broadcasting System, ELBC Radio, rejected reports of ritualistic killings. Colonel Sudu says dead bodies found in the streets might be because of people's inability to bury their dead ones. However, some Liberians say the police IG's statement is based on political sentiments.
The police inspector general in Liberia's recent statement was inconsistent with the Liberian National Police statutory responsibility to protect women and children across Liberia.
The IG's statement that was made, it's a shared disappointment. No responsible governor will make such a statement. We expected him to have said that there will be a wide-scale launch of investigation that will be able to detect as to whether there is honestly ritualistic killing in the country. If you are saying that people are putting their bodies along the street, formulate a strategy that will be able to track these people.
Joseph Valai and Tata Spakla are members of the local human rights advocacy group March for Justice. They say Liberians are unprotected because of limited government support to the country's security sector.
We do not have a sensitive justice system that is supposed to protect the rights of women and children across Liberia. And we also do not have a profound working relationship between the Ministry of Justice and that of the Liberian National Police.
The state is fast becoming a state of nature where strong people are prevailing over weak ones, and the culture of impunity is growing. People believe that they can take another person's life without accounting for it. We have organized people from across the country will be gathering on October 15th to send a clarion call to the government and the national community.
Meanwhile, Liberia's Chief Justice Francis Kokpo says alleged ritualistic killings are matters of concern. He says the government of Liberia should investigate the allegations.
Recent reports of killings, whether real, orchestrated, or imagined, need to be fully investigated and appropriate actions taken.
Police Inspector General Patrick Sudu has mandated police investigators to monitor, question, and prosecute anyone creating and circulating what he calls false alarm on social media. Rita Jrabwe for VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
The U.S.-based Human Rights Watch is calling on the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to pursue high-level leaders of the Seleka rebel group if the ICC is to deliver meaningful justice in the Central African Republic. This comes as the ICC this week began a pre-trial hearing of former Seleka rebel commander Mohamed Saeed Abdelkhany, who is charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity. The Seleka, a rebel coalition of mostly Muslims from the northern part of the country, is accused of carrying out attacks on civilians in cities and towns as they marched toward the capital, Bangui, beginning in 2012. Esther Tambe is the senior counsel at the Human Rights Watch International Justice Program. She says while Saeed Abdelkhany is the only known Seleka commander facing charges, there are high-level Selekas who are also implicated in committing crimes against humanity.
This is the first case at the ICC that's been brought against a former Seleka commander. He is charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity, allegedly committed while overseeing operations at two detention centers in Bangui in 2013.
Now, you said that in order for the ICC to pursue meaningful justice, it will need to pursue higher-level suspects. Who are some of those higher-level suspects? And are they only Seleka or anti-Seleka suspects also?
I think that the pretrial hearing of Saeed is really a welcome step for justice for atrocities committed in the Central African Republic. But as you said, it should only be, in our view, the beginning. And for the ICC to deliver meaningful justice, it's going to need to pursue higher level suspects. And that is both Seleka as well as anti-Balaka leaders. There are multiple other higher-level Seleka leaders that Human Rights Watch has documented have been implicated in crime, including many that are ruling large parts of the country and who are still committing abuses today.
Who brought this case to the ICC?
So the Central African Republic referred this case, well, the situation, to the ICC. The ICC is a court of last resort. It could never take all the cases of serious crimes in the Central African Republic. It just can't do it all. But it was the country that referred the situation. And now the ICC is operating alongside Special Criminal Court in Bangui, which is staffed by both national and international judges and prosecutors, as well as domestic courts that are going to be taking up some of those cases. So once again, we believe that it's really important for the ICC to pursue cases involving senior leadership because it can both address that way expectations of victims, but even more importantly, in this context, foster an environment to help these other courts deliver greater accountability.
How would you describe the level of atrocities in Central African Republic, the conflict there? How would you describe the level of atrocities that took place there?
Well, you know, I think it's very much for the court to assess the level of responsibility of this particular perpetrator. As I've mentioned, he's really involved, allegedly, in overseeing crimes that were committed in two prisons in Bangui in 2013. He allegedly oversaw those prisons and created an environment where there were abuses and torture against individuals that were in detention. And so, I mean, those are important crimes that need to be addressed. But we still feel that the ICC should go up in a command and go after other higher level Seleka leaders.
Esther, thank you so much again. So nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Esther Tambe is the senior counsel at the Human Rights Watch International Justice Program. She was speaking with us from New York. Botswana's Court of Appeal on Tuesday reserved judgment in a case in which the state seeks to overturn a 2019 ruling that decriminalized same-sex relations. The High Court had ruled in favor of gays, lesbians, and bisexuals in a landmark case, but the government is challenging the judgment, Mkundise Dube reports from Haburuni.
Members of the lesbians, gays, bisexual and transgender LGBT community will have to wait a little longer before they know the outcome of an appeal challenging a ruling in their favour. Court of Appeal Judge Ian Kirby said the bench needs more time before making a determination.
We'll reserve judgment in this case. It's obviously an important case that we need to research and debate thoroughly. So we're not going to promise a judgment next week as we might have done in the others.
The respondent's defense lawyer, Tia Morantao, said the LGBT community is entitled to constitutional rights and privacy. He said the laws criminalizing same-sex relations should be expunged.
The courts have a sacred duty which they must exercise objectively and without fear or favor to test any law passed by parliament against the imperatives of the constitution and to strike down any law, including a customary law that does not pass constitutional muster. That will always be so.
State Attorney Sydney Bilani, however, wants the earlier ruling to be overturned. He argued the majority of people in Botswana did not concur with the 2019 judgment.
Botswana respect the law and they respect courts. But don't assume that means they are happy when courts make decisions that courts should not make. Please don't make that assumption. When Botswana are tired, please don't think that they agree. And when they watch court decisions come down, don't think that they necessarily agree with those court decisions.
Bradley Fontaine is spokesperson for lesbian, gays and bisexuals of Botswana, or Lekakipom. He said regardless of court's eventual decision, they will continue to advocate for marginalized groups.
This is just another opportunity for Lekakipom to continue doing advocacy work to ensure that there is visibility, that there is continuous awareness raising and inclusion of marginalized groups, not only the LGBTIQ community, but other groups, including people living with HIV, people living with disabilities who are often sidelined.
Before the June 2019 judgment, Botswana's Penal Court criminalized unnatural offenses and indecent practices, with those found guilty facing up to 7 years imprisonment. Kondisi Dube for VOA News, Haburuni.
Fossil fuel industries plan to invest an estimated $230 billion into projects in Africa by 2030. But a report out by Oil Change International and Oil Watch Africa says these plans are not only incompatible with a safe climate future, but also face systemic financial risks due to increased movement of investment towards renewable energy sources. Bronwyn Tucker, a research analyst at Oil Change International, spoke to Ricky Stryak specifically about Senegal's investments.
For Senegal, we can see there's this big exodus of capital and huge headwinds for the industry. And so it's a really bad time to be starting to build up something like this, because projects get built, but they are supposed to be operating for decades. And looking forward kind of at a lot of the projections, all of these projects then become like really highly risky. And because the sector is being built from the ground up, there's a lot of costs to developing regulations that haven't existed before and just to building all the infrastructure that would be needed to actually extract and export all of the oil and gas. So just much higher costs compared to a country like Nigeria that has that infrastructure and those regulations in place. And then the flip side is that Senegal makes the kind of the right decisions then and decides not to kind of double down on fossil fuels as the world is starting to move away from them. There's not the cost that a country like Nigeria will have to deal with around finding new jobs and transitioning communities that are dependent on extraction to something new.
What about the fact that your report points out that Senegal, took on a lot of debt in the 2010s after the discovery of offshore oil, and not just the taking on of debt, but also some Senegalese would say, this is a chance for us to have more public coffers, to improve our education and health sector. What does the report say about that? What are the viable alternatives?
On the kind of using oil and gas as a way to boost government revenue, I think, like, from my perspective, it's looking at the risks and knowing that, you know, there is some versions of the future where this sector could help pay for better education and healthcare and all of these things. But
that was Bronwyn Tucker, a research analyst at Oil Change International. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Toronto, Canada. And that's it for this Thursday, October 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers,